Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches. Hello, welcome to Access Utah. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and with me today in the studio is Brent Black. He's USU's Extension Fruit Specialist, and we're taking your questions or comments at 1-800-826-1495 or go to upr.org and click on the Programs tab for Access Utah so you can email us your question, or you can tweet us by sending your question to hashtag AUGarden. Now, Brent, we were talking just before the program, and this is probably just as good a place to start as any. And some of our listeners may have heard it on NPR. Why does a store-bought strawberry taste so bad?
Well, there's a couple of reasons for that. One of which is how ripe it's harvested. The segment that was on last week was about strawberries particularly, and why do strawberries not taste as good if they're from the store? And the person that they interviewed talked about buying fruit that was produced locally so that it's not picked so green so that it can be shipped. And that was a major factor. So that was one of the major ones. Another one is varieties. And he went into talking about different strawberry varieties and how some are selected for size and color and disease resistance, and a lot of times as they select for these characteristics that benefit the grower, they tend to not select so much for taste, or they have to make compromises on taste. And so that was kind of the two points that were emphasized there.
So is it so basically just the varieties have the big way to do it, or is it soil that they grow in?
It's not so much soil they grow. It's varieties, and then how green, how close to ripeness that
because
they can
they're picking
be harvested
them so early to make sure
to make sure that they can ship for a long distance.
So those same varieties, then, if they left them on a little bit longer, would actually be all right.
Yeah.
Okay.
They'd be better than they are if you pick them green.
So they're going red while they're in shipping, or do they treat them with some kind of...
No, strawberries, the color develops before they're picked. And one of the things that he talked about there is if you look for strawberries that are red all the way around, if they have white on the tip or white up on the shoulder, that may mean that they're a little less ripe. So trying to find the ones that are red throughout are going to be closer to ripe.
So your best thing to do would be to go to your local gardener's market and get strawberries from there.
Right, or else if you know of somebody that does pick your own or that has a farm stand that grows their own, that's a good way to get high quality. And that's not just true of strawberries, but it's particularly, I think strawberries is a good example because anything that has such a short post-harvest life where they have to pick it so green, the closer you can get to where it was grown, the better the quality is going to be.
So let's stay on strawberries here for just a moment. We talked when you're here last time about possible varieties and day neutral versus June bearing and so forth. Once you get your strawberry plants and put them in, how do you take care of them? Because they with our soils, they tend to be chlorotic,
mm-hmm.
or can be.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you take care of them?
Well, so if you're just planting them this spring, one important thing to do is make sure that you pick off all the flowers this year, because you want that plant to spend the first year putting all of its energy into developing a strong root system. In case of strawberries, it's going to send out runners and establish daughter plants and kind of fill in the patch there. So keeping it from it's going to have flower buds in the young plant when you get it from the nursery. And if you let those develop into fruit, then all the energy of the plant goes into the fruit instead of establishing a strong plant for the next year. So the first thing is pick off the flowers. Oftentimes before you plant or after you plant, putting a good balanced fertilizer, N, P, and K, and micronutrients on the soil is good, and incorporating that.
So like what, a 15-15-15
right.
or something?
Yeah. Okay. And then... as it goes on, the P and K become aren't so critical as nitrogen to keep the planting going. But like you mentioned, in our soils, oftentimes we run into iron chlorosis, and you see that the leaves, the leaf veins are green, and then the area between the veins is yellow. And we see that a lot in our alkaline soils. And so particularly after the last 2 years, because when we've had really wet, cold, wet springs last year and the year before. This year we haven't so much, but because the under those cold, wet conditions, iron is even less available to the plant. A lot of the perennial plants, fruit trees, berries and so forth, got kind of behind. And so trying to get them to catch up again, even though, again, this year we're having warmer, drier conditions where we'd think it might be less of a problem, the plants are still having carryover problems from the past 2 years. So the best thing to do for that is to get what's called a chelated iron. An iron chelates, the iron is bound in a form that remains available to the plant in the soil. And so it's expensive, but it's worth it.
Well, okay, now the last couple of years, and I've had a big 5 gallon five-pound bucket of chelated iron that I've kept. And I looked at the price tag on it, and I think I got it maybe 6 years ago, and it was $30-something, which I thought was expensive then.
Mm-hmm.
I just priced it again. It's over $60.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What's going on?
It's expensive, but it works. And you can get cheaper iron fertilizers that are sold. And they're sold around here, but that are not the chelated form of iron. And you can put that on our soils, and you'll get very, very little effect. But the chelates work very, very well, and it really doesn't take very much. You know, commercial growers will put on a few pounds per acre. So that five-pound bucket that you have will last a long time. You probably used a lot more last year and the year before to try and keep up with the problems you were having, and it probably saved your trees. If you get behind and you see that really severe chlorosis, if you don't do something quick, a lot of times those trees will go into decline and they won't recover.
I've had even put in a couple of spikes into the trunk. I don't even know if that's the best thing to do or not, but it was so bad on my gala that I was losing a branch, and I thought I need to get something immediately into the tree. So far, it looks like, I mean, that branch still doesn't look as good as the rest of the tree, but at least it's greening up and doing a little bit better. So with the iron, you go into the store, and I've seen products that have sulfur in them as well as the iron. Does the iron ever, in those sorts of time-released bags, ever eventually break down? In other words, if you use them over the long term, does that help the plant, or do I always need to use chelated?
If it's not the chelated iron, we have iron in our soils,
right?
That's not available, and the idea behind those other types of fertilizer you're talking about is that the sulfur in the soil actually is supposed to, well, it will acidify soil if the soil is not too alkaline, but some of our soils are so alkaline that little bit of sulfur that you're putting in is not going to acidify your soil enough to make that iron available.
It might drop it from like 8 to 7.8 or something.
Well,
or
it might drop it from 8 to 7.8 for a few days or a few weeks, and then it goes right back up again. So it's we're fighting a pretty severe situation in a lot of our soils. If you're in 8 or above, it's just too little effort, and the chelate's going to have a lot better effect.
And there's no way to know that until you get a soil test done.
Yeah, you get a soil test, and one of the if you're battling that kind of soil, really the best thing you can do before you plant anything is get a lot of organic matter, compost or manure or whatever that you can mix into that soil and build up the organic matter, because the organic matter tends to act as a buffer and keeps nutrients available over a wider pH range. And so that can really be a big benefit.
Okay. Well, you're listening to Access Utah, and we've got Brent Black, Extension Fruit Specialist at Utah State University. Toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495, or you can go to upr.org and click on the Programs tab and email us your question. So what other plants, Brent, other fruiting plants have this chlorotic problem?
Well, the bigger question is which don't.
Okay.
We seem to have a problem here in general. I think some are worse than others. We see, from what we see, the stone fruits, particularly peach, are much more susceptible than the apples. We're also finding that among the peaches, some rootstocks are more tolerant of alkaline soils than others. All of our fruit trees are grafted, of course, and typically we think of selecting the rootstock for apples based on the size of the tree we want. If we want a semi-dwarf or a dwarf or a full-size tree or whatever, that's determined by rootstock. But we're also, there's a lot of research going on rootstocks, and we're finding out that there's a lot of other big factors that affect the tree growth, that the rootstock affects besides tree size. Disease resistance, drought tolerance, soil pH, all these things play a big, big factor. So we've had a research project going on for several years now, looking at different peach rootstocks, and some of the newer rootstocks that are just coming into the market are much more adapted to alkaline soils than what we've traditionally used as a peach rootstock. How soon those are going to make it into, say, the home garden nursery trade? Hopefully sooner rather than later, because we're really seeing some big, big benefits, and they could be really, really useful to Utah gardeners.
So with the graft, what's happening then is that these newer varieties of rootstocks are just better able to pull up.
Mm-hmm. Most of them are selected from more arid locations. They're,
I think,
adapted,
you mentioned the
better.
Soviet, mm-hmm. somewhere in the Soviet Union.
Yeah, there's some from
original Soviet
Union. Yeah, some of them from the Soviet Union, some of them from Spain, where they've been selected on alkaline, arid conditions similar to what we have in Utah, and finding that rootstocks that are adapted to that situation tend to be much more efficient at taking up iron and zinc and the nutrients that tend to be more of limiting for our climate and our soils.
So what makes plants that we consistently think of as bearing fruit, such as apples and raspberries and strawberries, what makes them more chlorotic than a vegetable? Do you know in the genetics what I mean, why does my tomato not go chlorotic, my tomato plant or my corn, but my strawberry will?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know. I think part of it has to do with the range at which that plant is adapted to grow. And often a lot of the fruit crops were selected in environments very different from ours and have been brought here. And I think that they tend to be more, have a narrow adaptation range. And so with vegetables that have been bred for a broader range of conditions, I think that makes a big difference. Part of it too, though, is from a commercial standpoint, and this is maybe not so much for your home garden, but a lot of times vegetables are grown on better soils, whereas fruit tends to be planted on rocky, more
maybe on the periphery.
Yeah, yeah. Partly because of microclimate. We want to plant our fruits up on the benches in Utah where there's better air drainage and not paying quite so much attention to the soil conditions. Whereas in those rocky, bad soils, it's not really suitable for vegetable production.
So,
and I would guess in your garden, you might have more organic matter where you're planting your tomatoes. You've probably been working at that soil annually, adding additional organic matter and building that soil up more so than where you've got your fruit trees.
And a lot of people put their fruit trees in the lawn.
Right.
And so then it's also having to compete with
grass.
With grass, yeah. Which usually wins out.
Yep.
Because it's a little more aggressive as far as mm-hmm. pulling up the nutrients. So, okay, well, that makes sense. So what about if you decide to put some of these trees up near the house, like you want to grow a peach and you want to give it a little more protection from the cold, does the foundation have anything to do with changing the pH of the soil if you have a concrete foundation?
Yeah.
It's kind of a weird question. But
yeah, not so much. But what you will see is that the being close to a building like that, it will change the temperature environment. So if that soil is warming up earlier in the spring, you might see less of the chlorotic problems that you would see where the soil is cold and wet during the during the spring. And like I mentioned before, when the soil is cold and wet in the spring, like it was last year and the year before, we see a lot more problems with chlorosis. Whereas if that soil can warm up more quickly, it's less of a problem. The challenge that you run into with putting them close to the house is that the whole house acts to heat it up, and you might run into frost problems by pushing your bloom earlier, and then you defeat the whole purpose.
So kind of six of one, half dozen of the other. And I guess for peaches in Cache Valley, it's always kind of iffy anyway.
Yeah, it's a challenge.
Is it, and I've heard this before, is it better with stone fruits to get a standard size tree and then just prune it according to what you want, or should you get the rootstock that you're looking for?
So historically, there haven't been a lot of options with stone fruits to get a dwarfing rootstock. Really, the where that's been best developed is with apples, where you can select tree size based on rootstock. And we haven't had, until very recently, we haven't had really any equivalents in the stone fruits. The other challenge that we're running into is now that they are starting to find some dwarfing rootstocks, some of them are just too dwarfing for our climate. We've brought in some new experimental rootstocks for peaches and planted them here in Utah, and the trees are so dwarfed that they just can't, they don't have time to recover from winter before winter comes again. And for whatever reason, they're just not vigorous enough for our conditions. But there's still not nearly as many options for size controlling. So there's not a lot of options there with the stone fruits. There are some now in cherry that are, I would say, semi-dwarfing and getting more with peach, but peach is still a bit of a challenge. But there are some cherry root stocks that are dwarfing now.
Have you been able to grow Japanese plums around here?
I don't work with them.
I just put a couple of them in because I tried some down in Torrey a couple of years ago, and I just loved them because I'm not usually a plum person.
Yeah.
But I thought, oh, these were great for juicing and making your own juice, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Be interested to see. Did you get any fruit set this year?
No, I just put them in this year.
Oh, okay.
I just put them in.
Yeah, that's one of the other challenges is they tend to bloom a little bit early. So unless you have a protected site,
earlier than the regular plums?
Well, all the plums tend to bloom earlier for Cache Valley anyway. So you're going to have to battle that, I'm afraid.
Well, they're kind of sheltered somewhat near a barn. But then again, we come into the same thing. If the foundation of the barn heats them up a little too much.
So which side of the barn are they on?
They're actually on the east side.
Oh, well, that's good. That's the best. That's your best option. On the east side of a barn or east side of a fence, they actually are going to east or north is really your best option. South obviously is the worst because they'll bloom very, very, very early. East side's probably a good option.
Well, it's again experiment in the Earl Garden. And if they don't work, well, then they don't work.
Well, we'll have to have a tasting on this program in a few years to see how
hopefully we have a tasting in a few years. So nutrient-wise, as we backing up here a little bit, we talked about the strawberries and they needing the nitrogen. Is that pretty much the same for most fruits?
So a lot of the fruit crops, as a general rule, the amount of nitrogen that they need is about a half to a third what your vegetable garden would need. So if you have a handle on how much you typically fertilize your vegetable garden, one of the things to remember, though, is if you've been building your soil with organic matter, because of that lower nitrogen requirement, oftentimes there's enough nitrogen mineralized from that organic matter that you really don't need to add any more, particularly once you have a perennial planting like raspberries that's established. In the first year, they need about twice as much nitrogen as they need for maintenance just to get the whole planting established. And once they're established, the nitrogen requirements are less. But like I say, if you've got a good quality soil where you've been building your organic matter, you may not need to add any additional nitrogen.
What about using a timed release nitrogen, something that just kind of gives it a gradual, kind of like with the grass, but it just kind of gives it a gradual.
So a lot of those timed release fertilizers are releasing over the course of maybe a month to 6 weeks. You're not going to put anything out that would last for a long, long time,
right?
Which is actually probably a good thing, because one of the one things you do not want to happen is you don't want nitrogen being released to the plant late in the year.
You want it in fruit production.
Yeah. Well, the problem that you run into with perennial plants is if you stimulate a lot of growth late in the year, say September, October, then they don't set terminal buds and they don't become dormant and develop the cold hardiness they need to survive our winters. And so you can run into a lot of problems with that. And so as a typical rule of thumb, we suggest that you don't put nitrogen fertilizer on past, say, middle of July. Earlier than that, you're in good shape. But if you put it on later than that, you can stimulate growth. Now, what some people do was put the fertilizer on in the winter so that the snow will leach the nutrients down into the root zone of the plant, but that's after the plant's gone completely dormant. By putting it on while the plant's still actively growing, but in the fall, it'll stimulate new growth that doesn't harden off like it should.
And what would you say is probably the most common mistake that you see people do with their fruit? Let's go to raspberries right now. What do people need to do to make sure they have successful raspberries?
Stay out of the perennial weeds, I think, is the biggest issue that I see a lot of. Once you get, once the bindweed and the quack grass and everything gets in there, it's really, really hard to keep that plant going and active. The weeds are just so much better at competing for water and nutrients. So I think one of the biggest mistakes that I see oftentimes is not cleaning up your perennial weeds before you put the planting in. You know, if you're going to decide to plant a raspberry patch, don't go in there and try and bust out the quack grass and go to town right that first year. I would say hit it with a good broad-spectrum weed killer, till it, irrigate it, get the weeds growing again and kill them again, and just spend a year getting the perennial weeds under control, because you're going to be way ahead of the game if you do that, and then stay on top of the weeding. I think that's really a major issue, not just for raspberries, but for strawberries as well.
Let's talk about some watering issues when we come back, but right now we're going to hear the latest edition of Wild About Utah, and then we'll wait for your questions or comments. Brent Black is USU's Extension Fruit Specialist, and our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495, or go online to upr.org, click on Access Utah, and send us your email question. We'll be right back and after the latest edition of Wild About Utah, so stay tuned.
Welcome to Wild About Utah, a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Holly Strand. On Sunday afternoon and early evening, the U.S. mainland will experience its first solar eclipse of the 21st century, and Utahns will have first-row seats. During a total eclipse, the Earth, Moon, and Sun are in perfect alignment, with the Moon in the middle. For the Earthlings experiencing it, the Sun's surface is totally blocked by the Moon, and the sky darkens. However, sometimes the Earth-Moon-Sun alignment occurs when the Moon is near its greatest distance from the Earth. When this happens, the Moon has a smaller apparent size that is not large enough to cover the entire disk of the Sun. Instead, a fiery ring of sunlight remains visible around the lunar edge. This is called an annular eclipse, from the Latin word annulus, meaning ring. And this is what we'll see on Sunday. To experience a total or annular eclipse, you must be located within the eclipse path, which is defined by the eclipsing moon's shadow. The path of this Sunday's eclipse is a 150 to 180 mile wide swath that begins near Hainan Island in southern China at sunrise on May 21st. The center line of the eclipse path curves northeast, passing between Yokohama and Tokyo, before continuing across the Pacific. Southwest of the Aleutians, the path traverses the international date line, where suddenly it's the day before, May 20th. Then the path curves south and eastward, striking the U.S. near the border of California and Oregon. Arching down through Nevada and Utah, the path slices through the southwest before disappearing with the sunset in Texas. The eclipse path encompasses the entire southwest corner of Utah. visitors to Zion, Bryce Canyon, Cedar Breaks, and Lake Powell will experience full annularity, as will the inhabitants of St. George, Milford, Kanab, Cedar City, Escalante, and many other southern Utah towns. Don't despair if you are outside the full eclipse path. Anywhere in Utah, you will still experience a very impressive partial eclipse. Even though an eclipse is an amazing sight, it is not for human eyes. Most eclipse-burned retinas belong to children or young adults, so be vigilant with young ones around. The common way to experience an eclipse is with a pinhole viewer with two pieces of stiff white cards. Punch a hole in one of the cards, and with your back to the sun, hold the card up so that the light falls through the hole, projecting the eclipse sun's image onto the other card. Do not look at the sun through the pinhole. If you have some shade trees, look at the images of eclipsed sun coming through the holes formed by the leaves. You may see little rings of light in the shadows. If the leaves have little bug holes, they will also act as pinhole projectors. If for some reason you miss this Sunday's show, you don't have to wait long for another, in astronomical time anyway. For on August 21st, 2017, North America will experience a total solar eclipse. The path will be just to the north of Utah in central Idaho and Wyoming. Total eclipses can draw a huge number of visitors from around the country and abroad. If you think Jackson hotels are expensive now, just wait till 2017. For pictures, maps of the eclipse path, and advice on viewing, go to www.wildaboututah.org. Special thanks to Michelle Larson, an astrophysicist at Utah State University, for her help with this piece. For Wild About Utah, I'm Holly Strand.
Wild About Utah is a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio. For transcripts and archived audio of Wild About Utah, go online to upr.org and click on the Wild About Utah link. Support for Wild About Utah comes from the College of Natural Resources at Utah State University. Information is at cnr.usu.edu.
Hello, welcome back to Access Utah. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me today is Brent Black. He's USU's Extension Fruit Specialist, and we are talking about fruit. If you have a question or comment, our toll-free number is 800-826-1495, or you can go online to upr.org and email us your question by going to the Programs tab. And we'll continue a conversation that Brent and I were having during that break, talking about watering situations and the best way to water your fruits.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them, I mean, obviously strawberries, because they're a little more shallow rooted, are going to require more frequent watering.
Right. And in the case of fruit trees, a lot of times, again, it's going to depend a little bit on your soil conditions, but they can tend to have fairly deep root systems. They'll go down 2.5-3 feet. So in any time that you're dealing with a deep-rooted plant like that, your best bet is to do a good deep thorough irrigation at less frequent intervals than you're used to doing for your grass or whatever. And so that by doing that, if you're irrigating too frequently and not putting as much on, you're not encouraging that deeper root growth, and you can also run into root rot problems.
So when I'm flood irrigating in my garden, which is what I do because I'm mm-hmm. not too far from the canal, I water my vegetables every week, mm-hmm. about every 7-8 days. But I'm only going to want to do that every couple of weeks with my
right.
fruit trees.
Right, yeah. And particularly like you were saying during the break, if you have situations where you have some subbing going on where you get your groundwater levels tend to rise as your neighbors are flood irrigating, that can be a real problem for fruit trees, because if you got sub water up there for long periods of time, you're going to run into root rot problems very quickly.
It's like they're just standing in water.
Yeah, they call it wet feet because the roots are just submerged all the time.
Okay, so if you can build a little higher up, or not be able well, to think and, of plant
and,
a little higher up.
Yeah, and raised beds, it, I know it sounds crazy, but people think of raised beds as being their little box gardens with their vegetables, but you can do the same thing with a fruit tree. You can berm up the soil and plant it so that it has, it's maybe a foot and a half, 2 feet above typical soil levels, and that gives it more root volume that's not so subby, that's not so wet through the middle of the summer as people are flood irrigating.
So the important thing is that especially during fruit development, mm-hmm. that they get adequate moisture. What do the various fruits look like when you don't have adequate moisture?
So a couple of things that will happen. One of the things that I think is a real curiosity, and it happens all the time in peaches and in the stone fruits, particularly peaches and sweet cherries, but it's more severe if you get drought stress, is what they call doubling. So you'll see little Siamese twin fruit hanging on the plant. I don't know if you've ever noticed that. And if you look very closely, you'll always see one or two.
In particular with what kind of fruit?
With peaches and cherries.
Okay, peaches, definitely.
Yeah.
I've seen that.
And sweet cherries are really prone to it. And one of the things that will make that a lot worse, I mean, it's a genetic thing that happens all the time, and some varieties are a little more prone to it than others. But if you get drought stress during when those flower buds are forming for the following year, you can get a lot more of that doubling than otherwise.
So that's a year out. If you do really great with water this year but terrible last year, you're going to get doubling possibly this year because, well, you did so well last year.
Yeah, and so I would guess, based on the amount of spring precipitation we had last year, that people won't see a lot of doubling this year because it couldn't get dry enough. And really the time, the critical time for that dry down period is about 3 weeks to a month after bloom. So we're coming up on that period now. So if we've had a dry spring, and if you don't stay on top of your irrigation, you might see more of it next year than you did this year.
So what will a drought-stressed raspberry plant look like? I'm having seen this before, I'm guessing that this was from drought, and my berries were kind of small in this one row, and they had a really great taste because they were smaller, and I'm just guessing concentrating the right. sugars and so forth. But
and that's
small.
That's true of all the fruits. If you have a little bit of mild drought stress during fruit development, it will reduce the size, but it will intensify the flavor. But it's oftentimes that fruit softens up too early, and it's not going to keep very well. And if you get skating too close to that edge, then you can damage the planting as well.
So you want to do a little bit, but not too much.
Right.
Okay. We have our first caller. We have Susie in Cedar City. Hi, Susie. How can we help?
I so enjoy your program, first off. I sometimes miss it. I just got back to town, and my first Monday, I'm tuned in.
Thank you.
So you were talking about stone fruits and different things, and I really appreciate this last thing you said about drought product. I noticed that the vacant lots with fruit trees tend to ripen faster than my trees that I irrigate. But I had lost a peach tree a while back, and it was such a glorious peach. But we had manure. We also flood irrigate, and my trees are down from my garden. But I can cut off their rows, and we had put aged manure on the garden, and too much manure got around my peaches, and it weakened them, and then I got borers in them the following year and didn't notice it, and I ended up having to cut out my peaches. They just killed them. So I imagine somebody told me that the too much manure in the water on the trees took out their iron or something. They got that weakness in them. But that was just a point I wanted to bring up and let you comment on that later. But my question, I have a local plum. My house was built in the 1870s down here in Cedar, and we're high desert. And it's a purple plum, a sweet plum, and it grows wild like a bush. You can train it like a plum, and it's not grafted. And it blooms about the time as an apple tree. In 40 years, I've only had small crops. Only once did I have a failed crop, and small only once in all that time, whereas I noticed most of my other stone fruit, the peaches, cherries, apricots, I get maybe on the average of once every 7 years. So my question has to do with that, as to, are there later blooming? How can I find out the later blooming peach apricot type trees that I can put in that maybe would survive, because I'm fairly protected where I'm located, being that my house is so old. But the pioneers used to plant these local plums, and then there's the Pottawatomie, the American plum. They also rarely fail their crop. But these tall ones, they're like 30 feet. They planted them on the west side to cool the houses down. So I've got a great stand of them, and they seem to have their roots down where they get water whether I water them or not, you know. But I always have a bounteous crop, and there's way too many to prune. But I'm just curious about the others. When I bought my property 24 years ago, I put on lots of trees, and I've not been happy with the peaches and the apricots. And my cherries I rarely get. So I just thought I'd ask you about that, and then I'll hang up and listen to your answers.
Great. Thank you, Susie.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. It's pretty much like that for me up here. My peach crop, about every 3 years, mm-hmm. I get peaches. Every fourth or fifth year, I'll get a big crop, and then something happens. And not usually borers. Usually it's just related. They just don't like the cold, mm-hmm. and then the plant dies back.
I wanted to comment a little bit on the peaches that she lost. So a couple of things happen there. First of all, borers are going to attack the trees whether you have manure around them or not. We tend to run into problems with borers. You always have to keep an eye out for those. And there's a good fact sheet that Diane Alston has on controlling peach borers that is available on the Utah Pests website. So you might want to look at that and be aware of that. The other thing that she talked about with the manure that washed down around the plants, when you over fertilize a tree with nitrogen, so you push too much growth, you can run into iron problems because basically the tree outgrows its ability to take up iron. So there's probably several different things working against those trees. One would be just too much nitrogen from the composted manure. One would be the borers that didn't get controlled, and then the iron chlorosis that resulted from that overgrowth.
So it's just not good peach growing territory, but we keep trying to do it anyway.
Right. And typically at the bottom of your garden, at the tail end of your irrigation system, may not be the best place to put your fruit trees anyway. Unless, of course, like she says, if you can cut off the furrows and water them less frequently, then you're going to have some benefit there. But as far as bloom time, a lot of the American plums, what people refer to as Pottawatomie and some of the other.
I love those. I love Pottawatomie jelly. It's one of my favorites.
And those plums tend to have, a lot of those, they're not really native to Utah. They were brought across the plains. They were collected along the plains and brought here and planted. And because they're used to late spring frost, they grow up, and they originated from a continental climate where we have spring temperature fluctuations like we had in Utah. They worked very well, and they tended to bloom late. One of the challenges oftentimes is that varieties will say, well, they're late blooming, but late is maybe a week or 4 or 5 days. And in a spring like we've had this year, 4 or 5 days may or may not have done you any good at all.
You just need one that's at least a couple of weeks, if not a month.
And, you know, in some cases, there were areas where peach orchards that were maybe 5 days early got hammered by a frost. The same variety in another location, it was 5 days later, came through okay just because of the frost cycle. Or a different variety, it was flip-flop because they just were at a different stage of development when that frost happened to occur. But one of the things that we are seeing as we look around, there's varieties, a number of the modern new peach varieties that are coming out were developed in California, and we're seeing that a lot of those tend to bloom early. They tend to not be very cold hardy. So when we have a really bad cold snap like we had in November of 2010, we see a lot of damage in 2011 like we did. So some of the varieties that I think I would look at as a home gardener would be some of the ones that are originated in Michigan, where they tend to have a little more harsh winter. The Haven series were all from Michigan, and some of the new
Hail Haven, Crest Haven,
Red Haven, those were all developed in Michigan. And so they were adapted to a colder climate. There's several breeders there now that are developing new peaches. The PF series that we've talked about, I think you said you had PF7 or one of those in your garden. Those were selected and grown in Michigan and are prized for being a little bit more cold hardy and a little bit later blooming. But again, is that going to guarantee fruit? It's going to maybe increase your odds a little bit, but we still have problems with late frost. And so if it blooms 7 days late or 10 days later, it may get you through in a border year. It may not.
So I'm just curious, what are some of the varieties that are being grown in California that we probably shouldn't try to grow here?
There's lots of peach varieties. I'm trying to think of some that...
But you say the fairly, comparatively speaking, the newer ones?
So the O. Henry is a newer one.
Dang,
Elegant
that's
Lady
why I lost that one last year.
some of those that are... and when you look through the nursery catalogs, it'll tell you, oftentimes it'll tell you where they originate from. And so that's something to look at.
You know, one thing that I have found to be really helpful is talking to a grower that's familiar with our area. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you can't find what you want locally, which is what I would always do first, I'm thinking of a company that have no ties to Van Wyl Nursery in Washington. Every time I've called there, they have been the most helpful because they know where I live. They know about the Cache Valley. You may not want to grow that because this tree probably won't grow really well there. It doesn't like heavier soil, whatever it is.
And they were able
to tell me which peaches to go through. They put me into the Haven series.
Mm-hmm. Several of the nurseries in Washington work very closely with Utah growers. We don't have any commercial fruit tree nurseries that are propagating fruit trees in Utah, but a lot of the nurseries in Washington work closely with our growers and are propagating trees for our growers, and they know what our growers are having success with and what they're not having success with. So that helps to have someone that has a little bit of knowledge of our climate and conditions that we're dealing with.
So how are the fruit farmers doing this year? With it being so early and some of the frost came in and got a few, and we're not out of thunderstorms yet, so some hail might come through.
Yeah.
How's it looking for them?
So the farms that I've been visiting, we've seen some blocks where we lost some peaches. Apricots are spotty. It just depends. It's really interesting whenever we have a frost, how you can get damage in one orchard and another orchard that's a few miles away can come through okay. The other thing that we've seen is that this year it's been very beneficial. Those that have the wind machines that look like the big windmills out in their orchards that can stir, because when we've had some frost, it's been strong inversion conditions. And so by turning on those fans to circulate the air in the orchard, they've been able to save their crop. So it looks, from what I've seen as I've traveled around, and again, it depends from farm to farm, we've seen some loss of peaches, some loss of sweet cherries. The apples, for the most part, have come through pretty well. The tart cherries, looks like we're going to have a very good crop of those. So they're still hanging on and praying that it doesn't start hailing, like you said.
You know, Susie was mentioning sweet cherries. We have, they're across the street, there's this old sweet cherry. It's really tall, and I've tried to grow them, and I get some kind of a canker that gets into the trunk from southwest wind air injury, but yet I keep trying it. But when I actually do get cherries, the robins usually take care of them. And,
yeah.
And I've watched, I think, the whole town of Hyde Park robins come to this one tree and just...
Yeah,
take it right out. They spread the word around. So it's just really hard. What do you do? How do you protect your fruit?
Yeah, so that's a big problem. The other problem that we have with sweet cherries is we have this western cherry fruit fly that comes and lays its eggs, and we get wormy cherries. I have a neighbor that's got a beautiful cherry tree, and it's in a kind of a protected spot, and so there's fruit on it almost every year. But between the western cherry fruit fly and the robins and magpies that come in at harvest, it's a bit of a challenge because you get either wormy or the birds are eating them or both. One of there are some things you can do, and there's guidelines on spraying for the fruit fly to keep it out so that you don't get the wormy cherries. I've seen for home gardeners, if you've got a small tree, you can net part of it. That's always a challenge. Part of it's getting out there.
I've completely surrounded this tree before. And the robin found a little hole somewhere and was in there pecking away, but then he couldn't get out. So.
Yeah, that's always a challenge. We've typically, when we've done sprays to keep the fruit fly down. We'll wait till the birds are really working on them and get out there and pick as many as we can before they cart them off. But about the time they start getting ripe, the birds come from all over. They know how to find them.
And then now there's this new pest, this new fruit fly that can deposit an egg in green fruit. So now we got it.
And it
deposits it in all kinds of fruit, not just cherries.
Yeah, we've seen that cropping up in the last two seasons. It's not really widespread in the state. It's called spotted wing Drosophila, and it's a different type of a fly. It's like the little flies that you get when you have overripe fruit sitting around. But the difference is that they lay their eggs in green fruit. And we've seen we've got some folks with the Utah Department of Ag and with Utah State that have been out trapping to see it's a introduced pest that came into California about 5 or 6 years ago, and it's been spreading its way across the U.S. And we have seen it crop up a few times along the Wasatch Front in kind of isolated locations. So how long before it becomes really established and widespread in Utah is anybody's guess at this point. But we have seen it's showing up in traps the last two seasons just in a few isolated areas.
Do we know if the cold it suppresses the populations?
There's still not enough known about it. It may be that it's dying out in the winter and being reintroduced. They found it on produce from the grocery store. So there was fruit that was picked and sent through the grocery stores, and the larva wasn't far enough along, and somebody brought it home, and the fruit looked like it was bad and probably got thrown out in the trash, and then out come the flies. Mm. So it could be that it's being spread that way and that it's just not really well established here. Both the last 2 years it wasn't trapped till later in the summer, which, you know, if it overwintered here, we would expect to start seeing it this time of year.
Well, I want to give our audience the web address for a lot of great information. The one that we were talking about as far as insects, it's utahpests.usu.edu. But really, the extension website, you go to extension.usu.edu. It's got a great search engine, and you just type in what you're looking for. You can do raspberries, and you'll have a whole ton of fact sheets that you can read up on.
We've also been developing a site, fruit.usu.edu, where you can go there, and we've got links back to the Utah Pests and to some of a number of the other extension fact sheets. One of the problems with the main website is if you type raspberries, a search on the extension website for raspberries, you get recipes and all kinds of other things,
yeah,
which to me is not as interesting as how to grow them. So we've kind of tried to accumulate some of those gardening tips on that fruit.usu.edu.
So here we are, fruit.usu.edu, and immediately there's a link for fruit, a link for vegetables, a link for organics, a link for high tunnels. Vegetables, yeah. So you can just click on them and go to where you need to go. There's also at the top of the page a gardening link, so you can go back to the Utah Pest website.
Mm-hmm.
So I have found a lot of great information on here, especially I was planting some asparagus a couple of years ago and got everything that I needed. So there's a fact sheet here for, say, raspberries, mm-hmm, if you're putting in some new berries.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
There's fact sheets on the irrigation, too. We were talking about irrigation management. There's some good ones there on orchard irrigation that will give you some hints and clues on how to irrigate your fruit trees.
Well, I wanted to ask you within the last couple of minutes, if you can't grow it yourself and you're relegated to having to get it from the store, what's the best way to determine the best fruit? For instance, I go in, we can't grow citrus here.
Mm-hmm.
So someone once told me, it may have been you and I've just forgotten, that when you're looking to get, like, say, grapefruit or oranges, you just kind of weigh it in your hands, and if it feels like it's heavier than some of the others, well, maybe it's probably got more juice in it, and that's another indicator that you want the one that's a little bit heavier. I have no idea if that's it or not.
I haven't heard that, but that would make sense. That would be a better way. It's really unfortunate that we can't sample before we buy, and some stores do that, and I always appreciate that, because if they're not ashamed of what they have, why not let us taste it? And if it's good, we'll buy it. I don't know. I mean, there's food safety issues. I know there's a lot of regulations that keep more grocery stores from doing that. But I like to buy it from somebody that has a reputation for high quality, because hopefully their produce buyers are tasting it, and if it's not good, they're not stocking it. So I like to be able to go where I can sample it before I have to buy it.
Okay, so you can't always judge things on appearances.
Really not, and that's unfortunate. And that's at the top of the hour, we were talking about that a little bit, that what we buy is based on appearance. And so plant breeders for the last however long have been selecting for appearance. And oftentimes that they have to make compromises on flavor to give us the appearance that will get us to buy it. And that's really unfortunate.
Why do we do that? Why do we we go in and select according to, oh, wow, that apple looks really red. And then you take it home and
it's got
oh,
a bitter
that red
peel
delicious and, isn't yeah. so delicious. And it's got a really thick peel. And,
all right.
And,
yeah.
My dad has an older variety of Red Delicious, and it's more streaked than mm-hmm. it is solid red, and yeah. they actually taste good.
They really do, and yeah, if you see the original strains of Red Delicious, they don't look anything like what we picture as being Red Delicious. They're not quite so blocky shaped, like you say. The peel has more of a streaked appearance, but it has a nice sweet flavor.
And it seems like the redder the apple, the more bitter compounds.
Right, exactly. So the red pigment has a bitter taste to it. So when you get these really deep, dark red appearing fruit, you actually probably want to peel it to get rid of all of those bitter pigments, which are also supposed to be good for you. They have high in antioxidants, but at the same time, they're not as sweet.
That's so funny. It makes no sense. Why are you going to peel an apple? Just right. eat through it. Now, usually with peaches, I think that's an acquired taste, whether you eat the peel or not. But I don't know. I never grew up biting into a peach without having first peeled it, so maybe I should be trying to go the other way.
It depends. I don't mind eating the peel. I like to scrub some of the fuzz off before I bite into it, but I don't mind eating the peel along with the peach. But it's what you're used to, I guess.
So this is going to be a hard question, but I'm asking anyway. What's your favorite fruit?
Oh, boy. You know, for what we can grow here, I think it's kind of a toss-up between a real ripe peach and a really nice ripe blackberry. Those are either one of those.
Got two of my favorites.
It's hard to beat.
Especially with some Aggie ice cream.
That makes it even better.
Well, Brent, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me back.
You've been listening to Access Utah. Brent Black is USU's Extension Fruit Specialist, and we'll have him back in again. And thank you for joining us on Access Utah.
Don't let standing water, seasonal flooding, and poorly drained soils stop you from growing a beautiful landscape. Try one of these strategies to manage the excess water and create a healthy environment for your landscape plants. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. Raise the plants above the water. Create berms and raised beds so the plant roots are growing above the seasonal standing water. Or create a traditional French drain in areas subject to flooding. These gravel-filled trenches capture excess water and hold it below the soil surface so it can gradually seep into the ground below. Or create a rain garden. They're designed to capture runoff from roofs and other hard surfaces that occur after a rainstorm or water that naturally collects in low spots in the yard. They direct rainwater into the ground instead of the storm sewers. And always call 811 before digging in. This free utility locating service can save you money and even your life. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
CD copies of Access Utah are available. Call us at 1-800-826-1495 or go online to upr.org. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSU-FM and KUSU-FM HD1 91.5 Logan and KUSR and KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan.